You're listening to Boston Strongcast, a place where we talk all things powerlifting, strength, and the occasional scientific nerd session. I'm your host, Kevin Kahn, the owner of Precision Powerlifting Systems, strength coach and competitive powerlifter in the USAPL. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get stronger together.
Hey guys, this is Kevin Kahn with Boston Strongcast. I'm going to do another rambling of my inner thoughts today on periodization and programming, because these are the things that kind of run through my head late at night as I'm trying to sleep and I can't shut it off. So I'm going to use this podcast as my psychological counselor to brain dump some stuff. I've been thinking a lot about long-term strategies for strength sports. So one of the things with the Eastern Europeans, so having trained with Chico for 3 years, multiple conversations with him, seminars, and him laying out his program at those seminars, there was one thing that I started to notice that was very common amongst Eastern European coaches, and that is recommended volumes based off of gender, body weight, and total. So Chico has recommended volumes based off of these pieces. And basically the Ministry of Sport in Russia every few years comes out with this chart. It's for equipped lifters, however, it still transfers over to raw powerlifting because it's basically just a guide to follow and basically a starting point for each lifter. And it kind of gives you a place of when to advance training and when it's not appropriate and whatnot. So the Eastern Europeans are very different than we are here in America. Over there, their powerlifting coaches are sports scientists. So that's what they do for a living. Here it's basically if you have a decent total, you've competed once and you have an Instagram account, you can be a powerlifting coach. And, you know, there's all kinds of even powerlifting certifications that you can sit, listen to somebody talk for a couple hours, and all of a sudden you're a certified powerlifting coach. So over there, I guess that's the difference between a state-sponsored program and an amateur sport that's basically in its infancy here. So over there, they are professional athletes. Here, we're not. It's a sport that's grown exponentially over the last few years, but it's still a very unknown sport. And even though the USAPL is probably going to have over 22,000 lifters by the end of the year registered for meets, it's still a very small percentage of the actual population. So when they do things over there, they don't just do it without a purpose, right? I mean, it's a state-sponsored program. The government is literally paying these guys to coach and lift and women to coach and lift. So everything that they do has a purpose, and there's research behind it. And a good example, right, where they care so much about the strength sports is everybody here talks big breath, big breath, big breath on the squats. But if you actually go through the literature, you can't find anything, right? There is nothing that says how to breathe properly for a squat. It's basically just passed down from the lifters before and just filters on down. However, in Russia, they have studies that go back to the 60s that say that when your lungs are 3/4 full and your breath is held for a short duration of time, you produce the most power. So this is why, like everybody in my group, we just take a small huff of air into the stomach and we rebreathe every single rep. It's something that was taught to me by Chico, and it's something that I started to teach with all of my lifters. So getting back to what we were talking about before is how they have these lifter classifications and recommended number and recommended volumes. So they have starting places. So I when I first started, I was lucky enough that literally at the beginning of my powerlifting career, I ran into Boris Chico. So when I sat there and I listened to it, it just, everything made sense. And there was an answer for everything. There were starting points. And it's like, this is something I can run with. And I was told early in my career that you always try to mimic those that have been successful, understand what they're trying to do. And then once you truly understand the principles and what they're trying to accomplish, you can start to tweak it and make it your own. So I just followed the recommended volumes and all the stuff he had laid out in that seminar. I was working with him as a lifter. He was my coach. And then over time, so this was not even that long ago, but I'm scrolling through Instagram and I'm looking at you know, friends of mine that are powerlifters, and I'm noticing how much volume that they're doing. And I know what their totals are because I've trained with them, and I follow them all the time, and everybody posts everything on the internet. So for shits and giggles, I started to add up one of these lifters' weekly volumes. So this lifter's classification would be, you know, he's a novice lifter, hasn't been lifting very long, doesn't have a national qualifying total, but he's a good lifter. His technique's very good, works hard. And I was adding it all up. And when I added it all up, it literally put his volume at a total that was recommended for somebody that was a candidate for Master of Sport. So basically, he was a class two lifter, which it goes class one, class two, class three, candidate for Master of Sport, Master of Sport, Master of Sport, and international competition. So a class two lifter is somebody who's probably pretty competitive on the local level. So somebody who probably gets a podium spot at a local meet, first, second, or third. Okay, it's great. It's where everybody starts out. A candidate for Master of Sport, this is your national level lifter. Okay, somebody not competing in prime time or having a chance to win a national championship, but somebody who's, you know, in that top 15% of lifters in the country in their weight class. So when I was adding up the volume, his monthly number of lifts was as much as a candidate for Master of Sport. And it was on the upper end of the recommended volumes for that classification. So I began to think, and it just, like, you have one of those moments where kind of a light bulb goes off. You know, we put such emphasis on short-term stress management, right? That's what we do. As coaches, that's literally what we do. We manage the stress of an athlete to try to keep them healthy and have them get stronger and be able to advance their totals at every competition. That is our job. So what happens? You take a lifter and you just start blasting volume, right? You don't, like here, there aren't any recommended volumes. There aren't any guidelines to follow. So somebody just follows something that they heard or read or might have done themselves. And not that it's wrong, but you're basically winging it. There's no real starting point. It's just, this is where I start with everybody regardless. And, you know, this is probably one reason why some programs work for some people, but that same program doesn't work for others. It's, you know, your starting point, your progressions, and your volumes are just not always appropriate for everybody. You're just kind of throwing something out there, and the ones that it hits the dartboard with, you get some success. And there's varying success amongst even the people who see success amongst in that same program. So you take this lifter, you start them out, you start blasting volumes, and you start hitting those volumes higher than their recommended volumes that I use, right? So I will argue that if you do that, your total will get bigger faster. No questions about it, right? You're literally, your body will adapt to anything that it encounters, and you are forcing it to adapt by increasing volumes like you are. You are literally putting that person under fire and forcing them to adapt. You will 100% increase your total, and you will increase it at a rate that'll make you happy and post constantly on Instagram. The problem with this is, where's the long-term thinking? So let's say you can get away with this, and it's not like this just lasts for 6 weeks and all of a sudden you're going to get hurt and hit a plateau. That's bullshit. It could last for years, right? So let's say 3, 4, 5 years down the road, right? You've been blasting volumes, your total's going through the roof. You know, you go from being a class two lifter, you're qualifying for nationals. You're probably somewhere in the, let's say in the top 50 in your weight class in the country, which is pretty competitive, right? There's only 49 people maybe stronger than you in your weight class in the entire country that steps on a platform. That's pretty impressive. Now you hit a plateau. Now what? You've literally pushed your volumes further than the capabilities of the lifter. So you can't push volume anymore. You've kind of exhausted that route. And now what are you going to do? You're going to drop volume and increase intensity? like that's probably not going to work either. It might be good for maintaining strength, and you know, you might squeeze out an extra 5 pounds, but the stimulus is not going to be high enough. We know, and there is unquestionable doubt that we know that volume, that mechanical stress leads people to getting stronger. We know. That's why if you do push somebody's volumes beyond their skill level at a given time, they will get stronger. It forces the body to adapt. It will happen. But now what? So for me, in the years that I was working with Chico, for 3 years, my number of lifts that I got in a month, the average, never really changed. Like, it went up a little bit as I jumped a classification level, but not much. So if I had just run a program where... my number of lifts increased every week, or, you know, every couple of weeks, or at a higher rate, my total would probably be way bigger than it is now. However, that 3 years that I spent with him set me up for future success. Because what we want to do, and this is why these, and this is all theoretical, right? Because I only know as much as I've been told. I can't read a lot of this literature because, one, I don't have access to it. Two, I can't read other languages. So I have to take other people's words for what it says, but I trust them. Now, theoretically, what we want to do is, you know, when you're a certain classification, is you take a volume and you stretch every ounce of strength gain out of that one given recommended volume. Right? And it doesn't mean that you're always just repeating the same exact weights and the same exact exercises every single week. It's being a lot more strategic than that over a period of time. So we can do different things with similar loads to try to keep the athlete from becoming bored and training becoming stale and plateaus hitting. So we can use 70 to 75% on a squat, and we can pause it. We can put it on pins. We can pause it in various spots. We can add chains. We can do a number of things with that given load to stretch out strength gains with it. And so with Chico, all of the variations that we did, my feet were always in my competition stance. My bar was always low bar. So everything was, even when I was, you know, pausing chains, all of that, all the variations were very similar to my comp lifts. So with my lifters over time, over the course of the last year, year and a half, I've started to add more variation to it. So not only can we just do that, we can do high bar close stance in that range. We can do high bar wide stance in that range. Just high bar squats, high bar pause squats, like everything that we can do with a low bar position and comp stance, we can also change our feet and change our bar placement. So we can stretch given volumes over a longer period of time. And with my lifters, there are some lifters. Nick Santangelo has been with me for, I'd have to go into his chart, but literally over a year and a half. His average number of lifts has not changed. His total has changed. He's gone from, he literally in April got his first elite total. So everything, and it was a 30, I think like a 30 kilogram total PR or something. Like, he's put a lot on his deadlift, he's put a lot on his bench, and he already had an elite squat when he started, but he still put, in that period of time, 5 pounds a test we're putting on that squat. And he, you know, as a 93 kilogram lifter, he's squatting 615. So we've had steady progress. He's missed zero training days because of pain or injury in this period of time. I'm gonna knock on wood for some good luck. But we haven't upped his volume. Yes, his volume goes up a little bit because his total goes up, right? But his number of lifts and what he's actually doing in the gym, the number of lifts, the average relative intensity, last set RPE, all of this stuff is the same. So you can stretch out volume by using number of lifts and those small increases in total, and you can stretch this out over a long period of time. Now, the volume increases, they don't have to be huge. You don't want big increases in volume because that literally can increase injury risk. You know, anything greater than 10%. And, you know, if you're going from 1 week and you're trying to add more than 10% in the following week, you're upping the injury risk. All the athlete needs is just a little bit more each time. And this is why. So another thing that like always stuck with me was those Eastern European coaches are always just looking for 2.5 to 5 kilograms per lift per competition, right? So you're talking every few months, putting 5 pounds on each lift, right? Over the course of a year, maybe 15 pounds on each lift. Literally, so again, the majority of them are sports scientists. They're professional coaches, state-sponsored coaches. So they're not just doing this stuff randomly. It's not made up. So my theory behind this is it's the same reason. They're trying to stretch volumes as long as possible. So if you add those totals up, right, it's having that long-term plan in mind. If you stretch those volumes out, right, and you just make slow increases in volume over time, this athlete is going to have a much higher peak. It's just going to take longer to get there. So let's go back to the example that I was using where we just start blasting volume early in a lifter's career, right? And their total shoots up, and it shoots up fast, right? And then they get stuck at that peak. So let's say they start lifting there, 23 years old, because this is what the data tells us. They're 23 years old. They have a massive spike in total all the way up to when they're 27 and then a massive fall off, right? And my theory is because they kind of blew their wad with the amount of volume that they're doing in the gym too much too soon, right? It's the American way, bigger and faster. Where if this same athlete, let's even, you know, say that we'll use the same time period and pretend that he didn't have 10 years of lifting experience before this age bracket, but let's say at 23, he starts training and you stretch those volumes. So you don't increase it at such a rapid rate, you slow it way down and you get every bit of strength gain out of those given volumes. Right? At the time he's 27, his total from blasting volumes will be way fucking higher than his total from following a more strategic long-term plan. However, once he has that fall off at 27, if he continues to stick with the sport and do what he was doing before and stretching those volumes, his total, maybe by the time he's 32, 33, it might take a lot longer to get there, will be way fucking higher than it would have been if he was 27. So this is the thought process that was going through my brain at a given point in time. So I've reached out to my network of coaches and because I wanted to hear what they thought of this, right? This is, you know, literally, it's like a light bulb moment for me. And in my head, as I'm thinking this, there's no fucking way I'm wrong, because if we put such short-term emphasis on stress management, why wouldn't the long-term matter? Of course it matters. It matters in everything. And like, even think of sports here, right? You don't get elite in anything. And it takes probably more than 10 years. I played soccer from the time I was 5 up through college. I wasn't good at 5 years old. I wasn't good at or elite at 10 years old. And no matter what any parent thinks of their 10-year-old kid, your 10-year-old is not elite. 10-year-old sports is not the same as elite high-level sports. It's still youth sports. It takes years to become elite. Years. Over a decade to become elite. I wasn't elite until I was about 18, 19 years old, when I could compete against any age bracket at any skill level. That's how long it takes to be elite. So yeah, there's some people who are going to hit this curve really fast, right? But then they're probably going to spiral out, and if they had just stretched it a little more, they would have been much more competitive. So having that long-term mindset as an athlete needs to be there. And even then, like, there are some people who see great success early on, you know, but are you winning a world championship? If you haven't won a world championship, maybe if you had stretched it out a little bit longer, maybe you would have, because maybe your total would have been a little bit more and you would have had the ability to do that. So I'd reached out to my network of coaches And I was told this story of Carl Christensen when he was coached by Detmar Wolf. So in 2015, Carl Christensen, you can watch this squat on the internet. His 490-kilogram squat looked like an opener. So apparently, Detmar Wolf wouldn't push Carl as much as Carl wanted to be pushed with volumes and intensities, because he felt if he did that, he would shorten his career. Now, I'm unsure of whether he would shorten it because of injury, or if he would shorten it because, you know, you hit that career peak too soon and the peak's just going to be much smaller. Or both. Maybe there's just like a thought process that's both. So I brought this up, and then Jeremy Hartman, who is now my coach, and you know, this is one of the reasons. He sent me this YouTube documentary on Demas, the Greek powerlifter. He won medals in four Olympics. If you're a strength coach, watch this documentary. If you're not a strength coach, watch it anyways. Like, even just like, you know, the culture of different areas and stuff. I think the majority of people will be intrigued by this. It's a four-part series, and it just kind of covers his journey through being the greatest weightlifter of all time. So, you know, and this documentary, it put a lot in perspective for me. So to be great, it started by chance. This kid was just picking apples. A coach walked by, saw that he was kind of jacked, and was like, hey, you should try weightlifting. Right? So if that coach never walks by, maybe this kid never even gets into weightlifting, and we never even know who this person is. That person walking by just happened to be a national level weightlifting coach. So circumstance plays a great role. For 10 years, Demas was part of the Soviet system. So exactly what I was doing with Chico. So it's a lot of submaximal work, technique, 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 technique. And then after 10 years, the coach has changed. He got a new coach, and his new coach did the Bulgarian method, so they worked up to daily maxes. So in this documentary, he had discussed, and I found this very interesting, that took 3 or 4 years to actually get used to the new program. You will never, ever, ever, ever find somebody here in America that is willing to just trust in their coach, shut the fuck up, and train for 4 years to get used to a new program. In 3 weeks, if they don't like it, they're on to the next Instagram famous power lifter who pretends to be a fucking coach. This is my podcast. I can swear as much as I want. I can rant about this stuff as much as I want. So the new coach comes in. He's struggling with the program. You know, him and the coach find a way to coexist, right? So he had allowed Demas to do more warm-up sets so that the volumes and stuff would be more appropriate. And this gets into the periodization stuff I was talking about last week, that the athlete's buy-in and their psychological beliefs play a role in their physiological adaptations. This is grade A coaching happening here. He didn't just tell him, no, screw you, follow the program. He helped find some middle ground and got some buy-in. And it literally produced the greatest weightlifter of all time. So at the same time, Greece was the best weightlifting team on the planet. So they had a few other weightlifters that were also just destroying the competition. The interesting thing is all of these athletes came from Soviet systems and then ended up in Greece where they were running the Bulgarian method. So for 10 years, these guys worked on technique and building volume. And then they decided, you know, well, they didn't decide. When the new coach came in, they put the gas pedal down and started lifting heavy. And it produced the greatest weightlifting team the world has ever known. The interesting fact is once these athletes left, Greece hasn't medaled yet, even with the same coach. So it's a matter of developing the right system at the right time for the right people. So this is a lot more complex than what I think a lot of people believe it to be. And this is why you cannot, if you're listening to this, you're a part-time powerlifting coach and it hurts your feelings, too fucking bad. Like, you cannot be a part-time powerlifting coach and truly understand the complexity of what we do. Yeah, if you have people train, they'll get stronger. Of course they will. The body's going to adapt. But you're not developing long-term athletes that could compete at a very high level. Like, America does great. Don't get me wrong. In powerlifting. But you got to remember, these Eastern Europeans are state-sponsored programs. They're not really competing in the IPF. Yuri Belkin, Andrei Milanichev, the best lifters in the world aren't competing in the IPF. Yeah, they're on drugs and stuff, but if Yuri Belkin wasn't on drugs and had a deadlift from a stiff bar, you think somebody's beating him in his weight class? Is not happening. Like, the best lifters in these other countries don't compete in the IPF. Some of them do, but a lot of them don't. So don't let the success that America tends to have go straight to your head. Also, a lot of the success America has comes from athletes that are older. Your Jennifer Thompsons, your Ellis McLeans, your Dave Ricks, your Marissa Indes, your Jennifer Milikens, your Kimberly Walfords, your Tony Harris's. There are amazing world champions that continue to win and be competitive on the world stage at a later age. But yet, statistically, they're outliers. So perhaps a lot of these athletes just did it right from the beginning. You know, somebody like Marissa Inda, I believe, was a bodybuilder first. So she built a lot of resiliency and, like, bodybuilding is a great start. Like, she built a lot of volume with accessory stuff to lay a foundation to be a competitive world athlete at this current point in her life. Like, it's not like she might have had early success powerlifting, but that success goes back to earlier days when she started bodybuilding. That was laying the foundation for her to be an elite powerlifter, a world champion powerlifter. So it's not just one person at that age that's competitive. There's a number of them that are competitive at those older ages. So it's not an N equals one, and it's not an outlier. And, you know, I wish we could just get their entire background so that we would have some analysis to be able to identify what made them world champions compared to others that take part in the sport. So, you know, I understand a lot of people who even get into this sport don't get into it because they want to do it for 10 years. However, that's sad because this is a sport that you can do for a long period of time. And I understand that, you know, Instagram exists and you want the attention and everybody to be like, oh, look, she's getting stronger. He's getting so much stronger. You want to write a bunch of PRs and, like, that stuff will come. It's, don't rush it, because what you're going to do is you're going to end up selling yourself short. You know, so when it comes to actually progressing training, right, how do you know when to progress? I think most programs just follow this weekly progression, right? Because every 7 days, somehow your body knows a week has happened and it's stronger and it's capable and ready to handle more. Like, yes, we view things in a training week, and I use data from a training week to help monitor my athletes, but your body doesn't know what a week is. It's a made-up calendar event by man. Like, it's not like your body goes, oh, now it's Sunday, it's been 7 days, I've adapted and I'm ready to go. But yet, because we just view it as training week and training week, programs tend to advance in that manner. Now, that's not coaching, that's writing programs. So this is based off of a periodization model that only looks at mechanical stress, saying that you need to continuously stress the body more in order to force it to adapt. Yeah, that's true. You do need to stress it more. Over time, the whole stressing it more each week, that's not true. You don't need to do that. You need to lay out a plan. And part of coaching is seeing what's happening. There's times where I'll have lifters, they will repeat the same weights every single week until it looks better. You know, one thing, like if you look at the story of Demas, he spent 10 years literally refining technique. So if somebody's technique is off, we're not advancing anything until it looks better. Put the right variations in there and the right weight on the bar. So if you have somebody who's pitching forward in the squat, right, and that pitch starts happening at 75%, why the fuck are you going to put 80% on the bar the following week? That doesn't make sense. All you're doing there is you're ingraining a bad habit. And bad habits take longer to break than good habit, than good habits take to build. So you need to use the appropriate weights at the right intensities, at the right volumes, with the right special exercises to lay that foundation. And here's one for you. So Dr. Mike Amato told me the other day that a lot of the research is pointing to tendon growth and ligament growth taking 3 to 4 years. So yeah, you know, I guess because of limited blood flow and stuff, we know that tendons don't grow as fast as muscles. 3 to 4 years, not 7 days. So if you're just constantly loading, constantly loading, constantly loading, there will be a breaking point. There has to be. And I think, you know, so if we get back, you know, to whether Detmar Wolf was afraid of Carl Christensen hurting himself or peaking too early, I think the answer is both. Like, there's, you know, when I found that out, like, there's just, I feel more fortunate every time I find out more and more information. And as I learn more as a coach, I haven't been coaching powerlifting very, very long. I try to surround myself with the people that I respect who've been doing it a lot longer that can show me the ropes. And the more I learn from them, the more I realize that Chico set me up so well for the long term as an athlete and knowledge-wise for the long term for every lifter that comes into my gym. We don't foam roll. We don't do special exercises. We don't do any fucking mobility work. Literally, we warm up with the empty bar. I write out their warm-ups and we lift. And this year alone, so we can even go back to November. So when precision powerlifting systems became a thing, when I had my own name, my own group, we have missed 3 training days since November. 2 of those people could have trained the day after. The other one hit a deadlift PR a week later. Like, these were just more, I'm kind of sore, we decided to rest. Nobody's missing training days that are with me in person frequently at all. Again, I'm going to knock on wood for this. And it's because load management is our number one job. And we progress training when it's appropriate. We regress it when it's appropriate. We back off when it's appropriate. And we lay down the gas when it's appropriate. And I have monitoring tools that watch all of this stuff. So I use the acute chronic work ratio that monitors an athlete. I can tell you all 40 of my lifters' average baseline volume. I literally can go into my computer and I can tell you exactly what it is. And I can tell you how far I can push them and how much I can't, based off of that monitoring tool. I have a spreadsheet that literally calculates that stuff for me. So if I know their ratio is getting a little bit higher, we don't push it. We just run the numbers. And on top of that, we monitor subjective data as well. So they come into the gym, they have a quick little mood rating that they give themselves on how they come in. Last set RPs are also recorded for all of their main lifts. So if our acute chronic work ratio is just a little bit over baseline, but they're feeling good. They've hit this exercise before and it was a RPE 8 or less on their last set. We're gonna put the hammer down. They are, and their technique looks good. They are ready to add more weight. But I have a monitoring tool for this. For some people, they literally can increase weight 2-3 weeks. We're increasing weight. For others, it's months. Because there are other issues. There's technique. They have harder jobs. They're mentally not as strong. There are a number of things. And that mental part comes with training as well. But you do need to take that into consideration. So somebody who is scared of squats, right? This is very common. You get a beginner, they're very scared of squats. A lot of times, it's because their technique's off, right? They're pitching forward, and it does get scary. There's weight on your back, you're pitching forward, it can roll up your neck. And like, that's the one exercise, like you miss a deadlift, nothing bad happens. Like, it just doesn't move off the ground. So people are worried about missing a squat, and they're intimidated. And under those circumstances, we're going to build success with submaximal training. So not only is submaximal training working on their technique, building volume and building that baseline so that they're capable of handling more volumes later, It's also building success and confidence. Like, there's psychological factors that go into every decision I make on a program, because those psychological factors literally affect the success of the athlete. Just like it affected Demas when the coach changed and he asked to find some middle ground. He wanted more volume. The coach let him do more warm-ups. There's the middle ground and there's the buy-in, right? Those are really important. So the first thing that we need to do when we start training is we need to develop a skill and we need to develop a baseline volume. You can't just pick a week, this is what I'm going to give this athlete, right? And every other athlete gets something similar. Because you know what? The ones who you just get lucky enough to hit the right volumes at the right intensities with the right weights, they're going to have success, but you're going to have a lot of people on the outside. And even then, the ones you hit, maybe you hit a bullseye and you get somebody who ends up being a top five lifter in the country or a world champion or whatever, right? But it's luck. Unless you're really tracking data and you're paying attention to this stuff, you know, because everybody's going to have varying degrees of success with the same program. And this is why not the same program works for everybody, because mechanical stress is not the only factor that goes into it. But it's like throwing darts up against a dartboard. Some of them are going to hit the dartboard, some of them are going to hit the wall, some of them are going to hit the bullseye. And if you're a lifter and you're listening to this, you don't just try a fucking program for 12 weeks, for 6 months even. Like, it takes, for me, to develop a relationship with a lifter, it takes about a year. Some of my lifters, when they started with me, Dave had a fucking terrible meet, his first meet. And it took us a while to get on our groove. But once we got on a groove, we've been fucking cruising ever since. And now his total is starting to show that relationship. You know, it's been like this with a lot of my lifters. You know, somebody like Danielle Bond, who I had from day one, we've always just been able to have that relationship, right? It was always going well. Then she dropped a weight class, and now we're figuring it out again. And we got to figure out what works under these conditions. And once we hit that groove again, boom, we're gonna have great success. This is not something that you do temporarily. And if, you know, you listen to this, you're thinking about me as a coach and you only want to do something for a month or two, I don't want you as an athlete. I would rather take, so, and it doesn't even matter about total. I don't care how strong you are. Bev, who's one of my lifters, who, she, matter of circumstance, right? She's walking Meg Scanlon's dogs, one of the best lifters in the country, walking Meg Scanlon's dogs, wants to get into powerlifting, gets hooked up with me, and she came in day one, she had never touched a barbell before, had never squatted, nothing. And she has literally worked her ass off, never misses training days, did her first meet in April, went 9 for 9, all white lights, and now is starting to build some good success. So now we're starting to change some things and she's starting to look like a very good lifter. Her technique's getting a lot better. Obviously her total's going up because she is a complete beginner. But this is somebody who had no background whatsoever and is just doing things right. I would rather 40 of those people than 40 elite athletes who think they know better than I do and want to tell me how things are going to be. Because over the long term, if Bev sticks with it, because it's only been, hasn't even been a year, right? So if she sticks with it, 5 years down the road, Bev's going to have a very good total. Regardless of genetic abilities, hard work and doing things the right way pay off in this sport. It's one of the best things about it is anybody can do it and anybody can be pretty successful in it if they do things right and they're willing to be patient and put in the time and the work. So, you know, I know a lot of this is a rant, but like for Bev, it's skill development right now. It takes years to build a skill. So we will continue to build that skill until it's extremely solid and I see fit to advance it a little bit more. And then once I feel it's at that point, then we'll start loading it up. But for Demas, it took 10 years. Granted, it's a much different athlete who is looking to compete at a much higher level than most, right? Trying to win Olympic golds is very different, right? But weightlifters have that strategy. Everything's written as four-year plans, right? So they kind of already have that longer-term strategy. We're like, for powerlifters, you know, most compete a few times a year. So it's, you know, they look at 12 weeks at a time, and each program is just that 12 weeks recycled over time. And there's your long-term strategies. Like, where are you actually trying to go with this program? So 2-3 years down the road, Bev's programs will look a little bit more like Kerry's and Danielle's and Dave's and Nick's. But it's a matter of getting there. Everybody's at a different spot, and it takes time. And maybe Bev doesn't stick with it, right? Maybe she decides, hey, you know, I've done a year of powerlifting. I want to go try something great. Okay. So she decides to go try something else. She realizes that, you know what? I don't really like that stuff. I want to go back to powerlifting. At least I have laid a foundation for her to build off of. And to me, that's more important than if somebody knows that they only want to spend a year, 2, 3 in the sport of me pushing them too hard and too fast. I feel it's unethical and I'm not setting them up for long-term success. I feel the majority of the people I have are going to be with me for quite a while. And, you know, I'm going to assume that when they sign up, and that's how I'm going to write their programs, and that's how I'm going to coach them. So in a lot of cases, like Allie had just started with me, I think back in April. She's been with me 12 weeks, so wherever that brings us to from here. Allie's just repeated the same weights over and over. Yeah, we've changed the exercise up a little bit, but her technique, she was pitching forward so much in the squat that she hated squatting and was scared of squatting. So we kept the weights very light, and, you know, to make it heavier, you know, if I'm using 70%, maybe we're taking 70% comp squats. I want to make it heavier. I can pause. That makes it heavier. I don't need to increase the load. I can increase the difficulty of the lift by putting a variation in there that forces her to work on what we're trying to work on. 12 weeks later, she's very upright in her squats. She's not pitching forward anymore. I see this. And now it's time to start adding a little bit of load. So now, you know, she's getting up into the 80 percentile area for squats. Some people start right there. Some people come to me and their technique's very good. So like Daniel, who's a newer lifter with me, his technique was very good. So we started with 80%. Emily, Tori, you know, their technique was not bad. So they got 80% a lot sooner than Allie did because they were ready for it. And for Allie, it was a little bit different. It doesn't mean we just lift light all the time. So Allie's deadlift, she made some improvements really fast in technique. So we started loading it up. So yesterday she ended up taking 88% for triples. So even though, you know, her squat, we were staying light and just practicing reps, we were able to push the deadlift, which at the end of the day works similar muscles, and it's going to push your squat a little bit while we're fixing technique so that she's still getting that intensity in there. And then, you know, the bench, I know some people want to make it to be the most technical lift. It's not. Literally, there's a Russian study that shows that there are 10 different ways you can bench press successfully. So basically, you're laying on a bench and you're pressing. And even if you look at some of the more competitive lifters in the world, some of them have good leg drive. Some of them don't. Some of them have big arches. Some of them don't. Some of them, their hands are close. Some of them, they're wide. Some of them, they're in the middle. So literally, you know, there are multiple ways that you can bench press successfully at a high level. So a lot of times for bench press, we can push that a little bit because the range of motion is short. It's not as technical as people think. So that one, it is what it is. All right, I'm sure you guys are sick of listening to me. I feel better after ranting to myself into a microphone for 40 minutes. Make sure you follow me on Instagram. It's KWCan. Follow our team, Precision Powerlifting Systems. Stay strong, Boston.